Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to the NBN Central Asia Studies podcast. My name is Luca Anceschi, and I will be your host this afternoon. And I must say, I'm extremely happy to have on the show this afternoon Adrien Edgar, who's the author of this incredibly interesting book just out with Cornell University Press. And the book is titled Intermarriage and the Friendship of Peoples, Ethnic Mixing in Southeast Central Asia. Hello, Adrien, and thanks for being on the show.
Hello, Luca. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So, Adrien, I'd like to start really with a question that looks at the research you've done from an author perspective. What did sparkle your interest in this topic? I mean, this is an incredible book. You've done more than 80 interviews. You travel around Kazakhstan and Tajikistan. You met people with different, for different background, different generation, different outlooks. And I understand there is a personal dimension to all of this. So how did the personal influence the academic in your authorship of the book?
Oh, okay. That's a very interesting question. Something I've thought about a lot lately. Well, originally my interest in the topic of intermarriage was sparked while I was doing my research for my book on Turkmenistan, when I happened to come across newspaper articles from the 1920s in which people were Turkmen communists were debating intermarriage and whether it was okay for Turkmen men, male communists mostly, to marry Russian women. And they talked about the effect this might have on their national identity and the creation of a Turkmen nation in the Soviet Union and so forth. So that was kind of the initial spark. But I think part of what motivated me to pursue the topic more intensively was that was the personal dimension that I myself am in a mixed marriage. I was aware of my husband is a Nigerian American, and I was aware of many of the issues involved in mixed marriages and as well as some of the scholarly literature on mixed marriages. There's a huge literature in the United States and other parts of the world relating to intermarriage, but very little on the Soviet Union. And so I guess it was sort of a combination of these things that got me interested, both the personal and the academic.
Yeah, so I mean, one question which I ask to every guest on the show, it's about the methods that you've used while researching intermarriage and the friendship of the people. So this is a book researched pretty much with a oral history approach. So I was wondering if you could please tell us more about how you approached the research for the book, and why did you feel oral history methods were the way to go to research the book and tackle this issue?
Yes, no, that's a great question. Well, as you know, when we're researching the Soviet Union and Central Asia, to some extent, necessity breeds necessity is the inventor of our methods. So So to some extent, scarcity of sources, scarcity of archival sources was partly the reason why I decided to go for oral history. When I first started researching this book, I read a lot of the Soviet literature. There's a lot of Soviet scholarly literature on intermarriage, ethnographic journals, and, you know, it was a very big topic in the Soviet Union, especially in the Brezhnev era. There was a lot of published material, but when I went to look at archival material, I discovered that it was going to be quite difficult to get at the kinds of questions I wanted to answer using archives, because personal archives, the sorts of things that historians of the family use in other countries, you know, court records, divorce records, you know, all sorts of personal files, they really can't be looked at in most former Soviet countries for 75 years. And the kinds of archival sources that were available, like at the ZAGS, the Archive of Civil Acts, and in the state archives, were almost exclusively sort of aggregate sources, statistics on intermarriage and things like that. And I wasn't really interested in having this be a statistical work or a work on, you know, how many intermarriages took place and how they increased or decreased. That wasn't really my purpose. My purpose was to try to look more at the partly at the scholar how Soviet scholars approached intermarriage, but also I wanted to look mainly at how mixed families and mixed couples in Soviet Central Asia experienced their lives, their marriages, their families, society's response to them, and so forth. And I just found that I was not going to have, I wasn't going to find that sort of information through archival sources. So I did turn to oral history, which was something new for me since my first book was mainly an archival book. But once I started doing it, I found that I was actually quite happy doing this. I had been a journalist before I became an academic, and I liked talking to people. So, and I realized that perhaps it was nice after doing a mainly archival book to do a project that mostly involved, you know, sitting around drinking tea and chatting with people.
Okay, so why intermarriage, though? I mean, this is a particular research focus that, you know, it acted as a vehicle in the book for an argument that transcended revolution, war, desalinization, and independence in a part of the USSR that may be central to our professional interests, Adrienne, but is still fairly remote. So why do you think intermarriage was the necessary focus to tell the stories you want to tell?
Well, I think intermarriage historians and social scientists who've studied intermarriage in other parts of the world, there hasn't been very much done on our part of the world. Historians in other parts of the world have found that intermarriage provides an interesting lens for looking at issues of ethnicity, of race, of how people are classified, how people subjectively understand the way they're classified by the state, and so forth. Intermarriage throws into sharp relief issues of identity that are normally taken for granted in daily life, such as how to name children, how to get along with in-laws, and so forth. Certain issues become people are forced to think about them more, I guess I would say, in mixed families. And so so historians, social scientists have found that intermarriage is sort of a lens for looking at these topics. And what I found doing my research for this book, I was interested in using intermarriage as a lens for looking at the lived experience of ethnicity in the Soviet Union, I guess I would say, or the lived experience of nationality, as they would have said in the Soviet Union, because people in mixed families simply had to think much more. Am I a Ukrainian or an Uzbek? Am I a Tatar or a Kazakh? Who am I? What do I put on my passport? Who should I marry? What religion should I practice? What should I name my children? All of these issues become much more problematic and, I guess you could say, interesting, contested in mixed families. So it's intermarriage turned out to be an interesting lens for looking at a number of topics that I find intriguing.
Yeah, because if the focus is about intermarriage, really, this is a book about ethnic mixing.
So, yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, and it's a book, this kind of mixing, it's very intriguing as a process, and it represents the fulcrum of the attention of your book. And what I liked is that the book does look at ethnic mixing not just from a couple perspective. So, you know, husband and wife, mother and father, actually even the in-laws, which are all actors in this kind of ethnic intermarriage. But it also, the book looks at ethnic mixing, it delves into it from a deeply individual perspective. And so I found that, I mean, reading the book, to use the word of one of the colleagues who endorsed the volume, is that there is this very perceivable and perceived gap between human experience and government policy. And this is a key issue at the core of your book. Could you please tell our listeners a little bit more about this?
About this gap between, well, I assume this gap between state policy and individual experience. Yes, that is one of the things that interested me most as I was researching this. The individual experience often, I found the individual experience captured most poignantly in many cases by the children of mixed marriages. I interviewed a lot of people who were children of mixed marriage. I mean, adult children. I didn't interview any actual children, grown up offspring of mixed marriages. In addition to interviewing mixed members of mixed couples. And when I interviewed the children of mixed marriages, this was when I really found a gap between the way the Soviet state understood nationality and the way individuals understood nationality. Because as you know, but as perhaps not all of our listeners know, in the Soviet Union, every person was assumed to have a single nationality. And they had to identify themselves at the age of 16 and place that nationality in their internal identity document, their passport. And this posed a terrible conflict for some offspring of mixed marriages who had at least two nationalities that they could choose from. But in many cases, they had more than that. Often parents were mixed and they gave birth to mixed children who had three, four different nationalities in their background. And these children were then forced to conform to the Soviet state ideal that every person was either Russian or Kazakh or some other singular nationality. So that, I think, that's perhaps the most, I guess I would say, the kind of most flagrant example of the way in which individual experience conflicted with, you know, state expectations.
And you obviously talked to people of different generations, and obviously different generations perceive the same issues, the same processes, the same factors in very different ways. I mean, how did you explain that kind of differences in your approach? I mean, is that a finding which you expected, or were you surprised by dealing with the differences in which this kind of intermarriage as a phenomenon was perceived by people of different generation?
I guess I should have expected it, just knowing what I know about Soviet history. But still, some of the way the generational changes came through were still, I guess, interesting. Perhaps not surprising, but just interesting that in the earliest intermarriages that I examined were people who intermarried right after World War II. Or even during World War II, so 1940s. And these were mostly Russian women who were marrying Central Asian men. And at most, these women often describe having to adapt to the local, the local culture, having to learn Uzbek or Tajik or Kazakh, having to live in the village, having to dress like a Kazakh woman. And they describe an experience of, I guess you'd say, assimilation to the dominant local culture frequently. Not always, but that's a story that I heard frequently from those earlier intermarriages. The later generations, particularly people who intermarried in the 60s, 70s, 80s, they lived in a really different environment that was arguably much more Soviet. There was a lot more there was sort of a common, much more of a common multi-ethnic Soviet culture that had emerged, particularly in the cities of Central Asia by this time. It was a largely Russian-speaking culture in which people of many different nationalities, ethnicities took part. And for these people, the common Soviet culture, these later generations, the common Soviet culture really created the basis for them getting to know each other, and also for them to created the basis for their family culture in many ways.
And obviously, the stories change very much whether the bride is a Central Asian or she's Russian, and the other way. So, you know, obviously, mixed intermarriage sort of work different way whether or not you have a Russian Central Asian or the other way around. I mean, so it becomes also a gender perspective book in that sense.
Definitely. The gender perspective is, I would say that throughout most of the Soviet period, which is the primary focus of my book, it was almost always Central Asian men who were marrying Russian or Ukrainian or some other non-Central Asian women. It was the gender imbalance in these marriages was quite striking throughout most of the Soviet period. I do have a few accounts of Central Asian women in the late Soviet period who married, you know, Russian or other non-Central Asian men, but this was pretty rare. One of the interesting things I found that I did not expect is that this gender dynamic has flipped, has changed dramatically in the post-Soviet era. Now there are many more Central Asian women than previously, who are choosing to marry interethnically. So that's something I talk about in the final chapter of the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And that's precisely the kind of information that statistics only don't reveal. So that's why, you know, there's a particular premium on your approach. And I mean, the book very much tells also a story about attitude towards relationship with people of other nationalities. And these are intimate, very meaningful, very personal relationship. Change as the history of Kazakhstan and Tajikistan particularly unfolded. So can you tell us a little bit more about intermarriage became sort of the backdrop to discuss why the processes, why the change in the history of these two Central Asian states?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question. So how the backdrop to how intermarriage provided a backdrop to for change in these two states? Or sorry about, could you repeat the question? Yeah, no, sorry.
The idea is that since you look at such a big, pretty much 60 years of history, really, intermarriage happened in the same place, Kazakhstan and Tajikistan particularly, but in different periods. So it becomes an instrument to tell us how this idea of the Soviet person and the fading of the principle of internationalism actually happened. So I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yes, okay, definitely. So part of the idea or part of the interest, my goal in the book was to tell this story of change over time. And what I did find, well, we already spoke about different generations and their experiences, but I found also that changing views of nationality or ethnicity over the course of the post-war period in the Soviet Union and into the post-Soviet period, these changing views of nationality and ethnicity had a big impact on mixed families individuals of mixed heritage. And in particular, other scholars have written, I'm not the first to say it, to note that there was an increasing ethnic primordialism in the final decades of the Soviet Union's existence. Terry Martin, Ron Suni, Marlene Laruelle, others have written about this, but I found it particularly interesting to see how this increasing primordialism was perceived by mixed families, mixed people, and how also it changed the way they were, it changed the response of the state to them. And this really, I describe it in my book as really a racialization of identities, that increasingly national identity was being seen as immutable, as biological. And this particularly accelerated beginning in the 1960s with the concept of the ethnos. The term ethnos was used to mean kind of an unchanging ethnic identity, a group with an unchanging ethnic identity over centuries or even millennia, which contrasted quite sharply with the early Soviet view of nationalities and ethnicities as being mainly cultural and historically determined. So you had this increasingly primordialized, arguably racialized view of nationality, of ethnicity, coming to the fore in the final decades of the Soviet Union. And of course, mixed people, mixed families were really at the forefront of feeling this, experiencing this, because, you know, if an identity is primordial, what happens if you have two identities? that doesn't quite work, or four identities. If nations have immutable characteristics that are different from each other, as many people started, you know, wrote or seemed to believe in the late Soviet period, then what happens if you have two completely different nationalities marrying each other and so forth? So you had, and then ultimately in the post-Soviet period, this primordialization and racialization of ethnic identity really in some republics, in some ways, turned into a kind of racist attitude toward ethnic mixing and toward mixed people, a xenophobic repudiation of mixed marriages. And I think that you can really see that this some of the racism kind of xenophobic nationalism that you see in the post-Soviet period really has its roots in this earlier period when nationality was starting to be seen in this more almost biological way.
So when we look particularly at post-Soviet Kazakhstan and post-Soviet Tajikistan, did you detect many significant differences in the way in which the practice of intermarriage evolved in the last 30 years?
Yes. I mean, what I found was that although Kazakhstan and Tajikistan are very different kinds of places, of course, and that's partly why I chose these two republics to focus on, was because they had different histories and different characteristics in the Soviet period. But I nevertheless found that throughout most of the Soviet period when I was writing about, there was a certain homogenizing effect of Soviet rule that tended to create similar experiences for mixed couples and mixed families, because the Soviet Union, the Soviet state overwhelmingly welcomed and celebrated such marriages. They were a sign of internationalism, of the friendship of the peoples, as I say in the title of the book. And people in Soviet Central Asia knew that these marriages were a priority or something positive in the view of the state, and this helped to kind of smooth over any differences. But what happened in the post-Soviet era is the trajectories of Kazakhstan and Tajikistan with regard to mixed marriage diverged quite a bit. Kazakhstan has continued to have this sort of multi-ethnic kind of happy multi-ethnic, this myth of happy multi-ethnicity, I guess we can call it, this Eurasian, you know, we're a Eurasian country and we have you know, we still welcome mixed marriages. And they have, in Kazakhstan, I think there's been more of an attempt to continue the Soviet narrative. Although there are, of course, many people in Kazakhstan who disagree with this. There are people in, and I do cite some articles from the Kazakh language press in the post-Soviet period that are strongly opposed to mixed marriage. You know, they have do take this kind of ethnic purity notion that you know that has become popular in some other post-Soviet republics as well. But generally speaking, I think there is more continuity between Kazakhstan, the Kazakh narrative of being a multi-ethnic Eurasian nation, and the kind of Soviet people narrative, whereas Tajikistan has gone more in the direction of ethnic purity, you know, and wanting to reject intermarriage and preserve the gene pool of Tajikistan. And there have been political figures, cultural figures, various people who, you know, who have argued, you know, against intermarriage in Tajikistan. And in Tajikistan, I think mixed couples and families have felt much more, much less welcome than in the post-Soviet period than in Kazakhstan.
So in that sense, and this would be my final question this afternoon, do you see the future for this practice of intermarriage being different, whether we focus on Kazakhstan or on Tajikistan? In that sense, this kind of exclusionary discourse of, you know, purity will influence how people in the future will approach this kind of interactive mixing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does affect how people view mixed couples. It may affect people's willingness to get married, although people have a strong tendency to try to marry who they want, regardless of what society tells them. And of course, there are lots of mixed marriages between Central Asians and, you know, and non-Central Asians taking place outside of Central Asia as well. I mean, there are lots of marriages between Tajiks and Kyrgyz and Russians and so forth taking place in Russia. So that's kind of a different story than the one I tell in my book. But yeah, I think that these differences between Kazakhstan and Tajikistan do seem likely to continue for the foreseeable future. And one of the things that just really that really struck me as I was completing the book was just struck me as sort of sad that, you know, we all expect a kind of eternal progress and things moving in a good direction with regard to greater openness, less racism, more progressive ideas about, you know, ethnicity and gender and so forth. And yet you can, there are moments in history, obviously, where we go backwards. And I think the rejection of mixed marriages in some of the republics of the former Soviet Union is just one example of that.
I mean, although this is a point which you make many times in the book, is that ultimately, you know, whether it's the case of the Central Asian man who returns from the war and brings over a Russian girlfriend with him, or more recently, it's people of different nationalities, people do marry whom they want in this case. So, you know, like the context may be different, but there would be more focus, I mean, more cases of this, you know, luckily. So, Adrien, thanks a lot for your time. Congratulations again on the publication of the book. And we hope that our readers, our listeners, will become your readers by buying the book or making sure that they are more closer to your work. So thanks for your time, and I look forward to reading your future research. But for now, thanks again to Adrien Edgar, who is the author of Intermarriage and Friendship of the People, the book that we talked about today on the NBN Settler Studies.
Thank you very much, Luca. It was a pleasure.